Hey Ken, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great, except that Skype.
Yeah, something happened.
Don't worry about it. I think it sets the proper tone for sort of international digital technology conversations when Skype doesn't work. It's the beginning of every podcast anyway.
That is true. That is true. Although I have to say, I haven't used Skype in 2 or 3 years.
Of course, why would you? You're a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old. Why would you use Skype? Doesn't make any sense.
That's true.
Where are you?
UC Berkeley, so in California.
Good stuff. How long have you been there?
For a year, since fall 2017.
Okay. So this is the beginning, sort of the middle of the beginning, actually, of your sophomore year, right?
Yeah, we started in August, whereas most other colleges would start in, say, September or even October. So I've been here for 2.5 months already. Not two and a
Wow.
half months. I can't do math. 1.5.
I can't do math. I don't even know what to say. But yeah, I mean, my college started at the end of August, right? Just literally right before Labor Day, which we always thought was strange because Labor Day, why would you make people work right before a holiday celebrating people that were working? It just didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah,
Anyway.
Labor Day would be a nice holiday for us, and then we wouldn't get another one until Thanksgiving.
I was gonna say,
Yeah, it's quite some time.
how did you end up at Berkeley?
I kind of ended up gravitating towards Berkeley for a couple of reasons. I applied to a couple of universities in the United States, in the UK, and in Hong Kong, and then in the end, when I had to decide on which college was like my best fit, I felt like UC Berkeley was where I just felt this sort of natural pull towards Berkeley because, one, I'm here studying political science, and Berkeley is famous for political science, and in many ways I feel like Berkeley and California in general is like currently the epicenter of a lot of public policy research, of free speech, of many of the new battlegrounds in the 21st century. And so I really
Yeah.
wanted to come here to like experience that for myself. And Berkeley's location in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the fact that it's near San Francisco, so it has an urban feel to it, but it's in Berkeley, so it's not too big of a college. That really helped establish a connection for me.
Right, so Berkeley is an interesting place for many reasons, right? Not the least of which that there's a history there of sort of being a political hotbed. But more than that,
Yeah.
people talk about Berkeley or Cal, as people call it, right? In the context of Stanford, MIT, and other universities, right? RPI that have sort of a more technical kind of STEM-based background, right? So
Yeah.
when people think about guys and gals, they go to Cal, you know, they think about science and technology and the whole sort of STEM curriculum. But in reality, it's got a pretty good, like you said, political science, anthropology. It's well known for a bunch of other things, right? And where did you
Yeah.
go to school here in Thailand?
In Thailand, I went to KIS International School.
Awesome. Really awesome. I want to back up a little bit, if you don't mind. I want to talk about that transition from international school into university in the United States. Right? Can you just run through what that senior year experience is like? You know,
Yeah,
this,
of course.
if there was stress around applying, where to apply, how to get in, that whole process, but also like what you were doing at school that year. You know, should you just study, study, study? Should you do things outside of school? How did that work?
Well, for me, I shouldn't start the story at senior year, but I guess I'll backtrack a little bit even further, and I'll start talking from 10th grade. So 10th grade is the final year of the middle years program, the MYP program in the IB. And then 11th grade is when you actually choose your IB diploma courses. That choosing transitioning between 10th grade to 11th grade was really significant in that I actually had to pick courses for the first time. At that time, I have to admit that I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know where I wanted to go. A lot of things in me told me that I wanted to major in political science. I guess oftentimes you hear things like, do you really want to major in political science? Especially in Asia, where there's so much more gravitation towards STEM. And so I was kind of undecided. And as such, when I chose my IB diploma courses, I kind of tried to like have it both ways. I chose things like IB business and IB economics as social sciences because in the end, those are the things I was interested in. But also chose higher level maths and standard level physics. as like my backup choices, kind of, to see whether I have aptitude towards math and science. And in the end, I felt like that experience really shaped me because, one, it really challenged me. I'm okay at math, but I wouldn't say that I'm terribly good at it. And so higher level math was kind of out of my league. I found that really difficult. It was the source of much, you know, anguish and tears. Physics, I definitely am not good at physics. I really struggle with the material. Sometimes I would spend my days just thinking, why did Isaac Newton have to invent this formula? He really didn't have to inflict this pain on hundreds of millions of students across the world after he died. You know, I just struggled so much with the material. And so that kind of made my mind up that I wanted to go towards the social sciences route for sure. The issue, though, is that with these courses, my personal interest is mostly in politics and public policy, but the courses that we're taking were not really directly politics related. In many ways, I felt a kind of fatigue from my academics. I didn't feel fulfilled from the course that I was taking. And so I did spend a lot of time in the final 2 years of high school doing things in the student council at KIS, where I felt like I was getting to develop like leadership skills. I was getting to make decisions, meet with the administration. And it was really things I was interested in. And so I found myself juggling academics while spending more and more time with the student council as well.
Can you just differentiate for me, if your memory serves you, yeah, what the types of things that you were learning from those extracurricular activities, right? In other words, sure, the mathematics is really straightforward, what you're learning, right? You're learning physics. It's really straightforward. You know beforehand what you're going to learn when you go in, and you know when you're done what you learned. It's really easy, and most of the kids in the class will learn the same thing. But the ECAs, right, are really different because there's no prescribed thing to learn. And, you know, five kids can go through the same ECA and learn five completely different things and have five completely different perspectives, right? I'm really interested in how you got interested in sort of political science and also politics itself, but also what you learned when you came out of those experiences that were, remember, extra to your academics. And it's important to note because that you'll learn for later in life, like how those experiences impact who you are and what you think.
I guess from here, I need to backtrack a little bit more, even further from that. So to talk about my interest in politics, I was a real big history nerd in middle school. Like, I would spend my time like reading like thick history books that would have horrified most of my friends, but it's okay. That was my nerdy side. And so I did a lot of that. But then when I was in ninth grade, and that was when the political turmoil in Thailand really kind of hit a climax, I came to this realization that politics is basically history in action. I kind of moved into like the political sphere and started thinking a lot about current issues. I wrote a lot about the political turmoil in 2013 and 2014. It was an exciting experience for me because I wrote an article about the protests in Thailand, and it ended up being shared on Facebook around 2,000 times. And I was really surprised by that. I was like, wow, my content went viral, you know? What happened after that was that it wasn't something that I had expected at all. But it ended up catching the interest of the Constitution Drafting Committee in Thailand. They actually invited me to a meeting at Parliament to talk a little bit about, say, how I, as a teenager at that time, would think about the draft constitution that a government was preparing, how I would approach promoting it. Just step by step, I became more and more like involved and interested in politics in Thailand at that time. So that's how I got interested in politics.
What did it feel like after you wrote that article that got the attention of the committee that was drafting the constitution? Were you surprised?
I was extremely surprised. And when I went to Parliament, like I was at the gate and I had no idea like what I was supposed to do. And then someone came down and picked me up, and I ended up in a meeting room with, I remember there were some retired military leaders, some officials from the provinces, some leading businessmen, and they were all talking about how they wanted to promote the draft constitution. And it was a really inspiring experience because you could just feel the passion that they had, the commitment that they had to the country. And I kept thinking to myself that I'm in a meeting behind closed doors, yet these people are all talking about how they want to serve this country, how they want to bring good governance and democracy to Thailand. And so that was something that left quite a footprint in my mind.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to be part of history in action, particularly at such a young age, right? I also think it's important to note that when you look at anything from the outside, you can have your own sort of biased view about what people are trying to accomplish or what's actually going on. But once you get inside and you see that passion that people have and the arguments that they're doing back and forth about what is the right way to construct that constitution and to, you know, create the right environment for democracy in Thailand and all the things that they were trying to figure out, you have to have a much sort of higher view of these people that are just working really hard to make the country a better place, regardless of whether you agree with their individual policies or their politics.
And that's really true, because like now that I actually study political science at a college level and that I've had more time to like think about these issues, right. I can't say I agree with like everything that was in that constitution. In fact, I'm not even sure I can say that I agree with most things in that constitution anymore. But every time I think of this, I still remind myself of the fact that I did hear the people who were working on this. I heard their passion for public service, and that in the end, they had the best intentions in mind. And so this has stuck with me. Like, even when I look at political debates today, it's important to keep in mind that we have this tendency in an increasingly polarized society in many countries to try to paint the other side as the bad guys. But in the end, a lot of people are simply working to further the goals they believe are the best for the country.
I like to say that I don't mind your position on any particular political issue as long as I believe you're operating in good faith.
Right.
Okay? And I can have my own definition of what operating in good faith means, but like you said, I don't want to paint the other side, whatever the other side is, with such broad strokes that says they're bad people, right? Because if they're operating in good faith, they're not, but they just disagree with what I believe. And that's fair enough. You know, two people are allowed to have a different point of view. As we said earlier, you know, if five kids go through the same ECA, we don't know what knowledge they're going to come out with or what that experience has taught them over time. And it could it be five different things completely.
Yes.
Now, as a political science major, right, at the college level, with what you've experienced then, what would you tell yourself as a student council member, as a member of that committee that was drafting the Constitution, what would you tell yourself now with the extra knowledge you have about what you'd do differently then based on what you've learned?
This is a really interesting question, and it is something that I still grapple with today, because I feel like I myself have had a shifting, I guess, in my political leanings over time. I used to be someone, I'll put it this way, when I was in high school and when I started college, I did have doubts about, say, the sustainability in the long term of Thailand's democratic system and whether or not democracy is something that's best suited to a developing country like Thailand. Like, should there be other priorities that we should be trying to achieve before going to democracy? Like, should we focus on the economy before we try to make a transition to democracy? As I've engaged with this issue more, a realization that has come to me is that questioning the long-term sustainability of democracy doesn't mean that we shouldn't work to achieve it anyway. In the end, a democratic, pluralistic society is a goal that is intended to create good governance in a way that takes into account the majority of the people. There are simply no guarantees in other systems that the same can be achieved. And so I really feel like this shift in me of realizing that we need to work to advance democracy, to advance human rights, to advance good governance in Thailand is not something that should be sidelined while we try to pursue other goals, but should be something that we try to achieve together.
Okay, so you've just raised two really interesting points to me. Let's just talk about the sustainability of democracy over the long term, and then talk about it in the short term to start. In the short term, one of the tenets or one of the things that I understand about democracy, everybody gets a vote, right? And everybody gets an equal vote, right? So somebody who is at Berkeley or at Cal, right, gets the same vote as somebody who didn't graduate from high school. So how do you deal in a democratic society, in a pluralistic society, with the education bifurcation and an information bifurcation? And how do you convince an uneducated person about the same things that an educated person believes and create that level of equality in the way they believe that that democratic system should run?
That's a really good point, and it's not something that I have the answer to. From my own perspective, we often make the argument that democracy in Thailand is not sustainable and that it breaks down. I did my own independent research project, so I brought up a history of Thailand's democratic past. So since 1932, what has happened in Thailand, just kind of like running through the major events. I wrote this on my blog as a way to try to promote awareness of Thailand's democratic history and also to like just as a way for me to synthesize all this information myself. And something that occurred to me was, I feel like from this macro perspective, it's really difficult for us to try to make the argument that democracy is sustainable in Thailand simply because it's broken down so much. I think that we need to move away from this perspective, because democracy is often broken down. That means that the people are not able to run a well-functioning democracy. And instead, they need to work to try to promote a level of political literacy that allows people to fully engage in a civic society that facilitates democracy. One of my own personal passions is for trying to promote this political literacy. It's why I write in order to try to clarify complicated political issues, to try to raise awareness of issues and current events that people may not be aware of. It goes hand in hand with what the state can do in trying to, you know, launch initiatives for better education and just to increase political awareness in general, because there's just no way that you can run a democracy if the public is not engaged and are uninformed. In addition, we often talk about things like, say, do we live in a post-truth world? Do we live in a world where facts don't matter anymore? I was reading a book this summer called Factfulness. Factfulness is all about, you know, how do we adopt a fact-based view of the world? And trying to do this is also really important, because democracy cannot thrive unless we have common sense of agreement of what facts are and what is fact and what is fiction.
Democracy itself is just a really noble experiment, and it's an ongoing experiment, right? And it relies on a few very basic things, one of which is, if through a democratic process the majority of people disagree with what I would like to do, then I just sit back and say, I have lost that particular argument, and we're going to move on as a society or as a community and do what the other people want to do. And we do that peacefully, and we do that nicely, and we go through a process, and we then understand that the next time that thing comes up for a vote or is available to decide, the country or the community can change its mind. But democracy breaks down instantaneously when people no longer believe that the system that has been set up to enable that democracy is broken or fixed or corrupt. So if I just don't believe, this gets back to what we were talking before, that somebody or a group of somebodies are operating in good faith, then I'm going to exert excessive force to push them to my side. And that's when democracy breaks down, when people just don't believe that the system itself is operating in good faith. And that's, I think, really interesting. And it does get back to this factfulness. And that's why I always ask about education. In other words, you, as an educated elite, just like I am, have both... But we are. We have to agree to that. Like, you didn't get to Cal by accident. There was an entire process, right? The same way I didn't get a great economics degree by accident, right? I went to a good public school, I went to private school, and then I went to college, and then, you know, here I am operating in the world just like you, just 30 years earlier, right? But there are plenty of people that never have that access. And I think that's why you have to back up, like you said, and start with, how do you get people educated, get them access to information, so that then that democratic process both feels fair and sustainable?
There's also a level of adherence to democratic norms that we need to start expecting of our politicians. Over the summer, I wrote an article and I submitted it to the Bangkok Post, and they published it. What I wrote about in that article was how we need to foster norms to sustain democracy. It's based on a book called How Democracies Die. They argue that we need two norms. So one would be mutual tolerance, where competing parties need to both accept each other as legitimate rivals. The second norm that we need is institutional forbearance, the idea that politicians have to exercise a level of restraint in how they operate. How we foster these norms is a really interesting question. I'm still trying to come up with more answers to these questions myself.
Right. I mean, I think there's doubt in my mind as to whether humans as a species overall, not in any particular country, in any particular community, but just on an overall basis, have decided that they're going to abide by those norms as you describe them. Because you can look at democracies globally, the biggest democracy in the world, right? India, like one of the most prominent democracies, the United States, but even throughout Europe and other places, you can see that it's just so tenuous. And as soon as people start violating those norms, what you really want is the system come in itself and have protections, right? But when those break down as well, you just have unanticipated consequences.
Yeah, I agree. I really do agree.
I want to spend a little bit more time talking about why you write. When you wrote your first article, and I'd love to get a copy of that article as well, right? And you have impact. So you have this unintended or unanticipated impact, right? And then you wrote another thing, and then people listened more. So 2,000 for the first one, 6,000 for the next one. And then you get called in by the government and have them say, what is your view as a teenager on how the Constitution should look like? And here you are. You know, your parents must be shocked, your friends don't believe you, and then you're sitting in this closed-door meeting with people 30, 40 years older than you are in this draft constitution meeting, and you're thinking, wow, how did I get here? But it teaches you that really good, thoughtful writing can have power. So what do you do now that you have an audience, and And how do you use your writing to have positive impact?
I do want to clarify one thing, that it wasn't really a meeting on the draft constitution itself, but more on how to promote the draft constitution. For my writing, it's actually really funny because I can actually see my views increase when there's like an important issue in current events. There aren't issues that people are interested in. My views kind of take a dip and people don't really engage. It's almost like my writing thrives on crisis, which is kind of sad, but that's just how it is with political writing. For me, my own personal goal is to write to promote political literacy.
How is school going anyway this semester? Like you said, it's in California. It should be fun in a way, no?
This year, I feel, is smoother sailing than last year because in my high school, my graduating class was 30 people. The class of 2021, my year at UC Berkeley, is 7,000 people.
That's so good. How many kids did you say were in your graduating class? 30?
30, yeah.
That is so good.
That's really good. It was a really tight-knit community, and I really benefited from, like, say, the mentorship from teachers, getting basically almost undivided attention.
Yeah.
The sheer number of people who are here is kind of shocking, honestly. And when you come to Berkeley, I mean, it's impossible to try to talk to everyone, right? Like, you can't be friends with your entire class. It's 7,000 people. Right. So what you need to do is treat Berkeley like a big city where there are many opportunities, and then try to carve out your own neighborhood and thrive in that neighborhood. So I joined student government here as well. I'm their marketing director, so I work on their on branding and communications. I find it really fun. It's something that I'm really excited to do every day. I've also been joining other organizations as well to try to just explore areas that are not politics related, just because I want to like broaden my horizons.
It sounds like an incredible experience. And I like this whole idea. Even before you said it, I was thinking, yeah, you have to find your neighborhood in a city, right? All the neighborhoods are great, but which is the one that kind of agrees with you most or even agrees with you the least? And then you go there and at least learn something about yourself and about what other people are doing. It's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, like at Berkeley, size is something that really impacts all aspects of the experience here. So firstly, the class sizes are massive. My current economics class has 800 people enrolled. I don't study computer science, but I know the largest computer science class here has about 2,000 students enrolled. It's just a massive class size, right? I don't think professors are giving lectures anymore. They're basically performing for you. And the impact that does come out of the class size is that you often get waitlisted because there's just so many people trying to compete for such few seats. That's frustrating, but that's okay. That's something you can adjust to. You can sort of carve out your own friend group. I guess that's a really good thing because you can just find the friends you really like and make your own friend group. But the downside is that for many people here, if you're an introvert and you find it hard connecting, the fact that you don't meet the same people over and over again can make it really hard to form meaningful social relationships. And so that's why here, like in student government, we take the concept of mental health seriously. We advocate for mental health resources all the time. It's just Cal's size that is both an opportunity and also both something that makes life here more difficult at the same time.
I mean, mental health as a university student, particularly in your first or second year, I think when you're still adjusting to being away from like your most well-known support system, whether it's your family or just the kids with whom you've grown up, that's a real adjustment, right? And I had a slightly different experience. So there are 7,000 kids in your class, right? In your entrance class.
Yes.
There were 400 kids in mine when I went to school. I went to a small college in Connecticut. The college that I attended was the same size as the high school that I attended, although the class sizes were smaller. And to be fair, you know, you're having 1,000, 2,000 people in a class. I had 40 was my biggest class in college, and most of my class sizes were like 15 to 20 people, which is ideal. Yeah, it was ideal for me. And I think the same way you said, you know, your graduating class at KIS had 30 students in it. I mean, that's perfect because there's no better way to learn than having sort of direct attention from a teacher or professor. But again, part of the adjustment of going from high school to college or to university is that the world is a much bigger place than just your neighborhood. And you have to figure out a way to operate inside of places that you are familiar with and places with which you're not familiar at scale. And that's one of the transitions that university gives you. And it sounds like people, at least where you are, talking about it. And that's cool.
I guess if you just sit in your dorm room and you don't do anything, then I guess you never really get to take advantage of the opportunities that Cal has to offer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but if you do go out, there's just so much that you can do. Like last semester, I was involved in research for a political science professor, it was kind of a strange topic. It was about multicultural political philosophy, which is something that like I had never really engaged with before. Mm-hmm. But I did get to do research on that, and that was interesting. And there are so many research opportunities here where you get to get one-on-one interaction with like really world-class professors. Because it's just such a big school, you just get like public luminaries just come and go all the time. I got to hear from the founder of Politico.com, which is like my favorite news site ever.
Do you follow Axios?
I love Axios. So Jim Vandenhei, he came and he talked about Axios. It's really cool.
It is really cool. So the last thing I'll leave you with, and then I'll let you go, right, is that one of the things that at least I learned, and I think that people should learn or should be taught, actually, is that when you're in an environment where there are 30 students, if those students break down into three classes, it's 10 students in a class. And it's very easy for the teachers or the instructors or the educators to know who you are and to single you out and to say, okay, Ken, I want you to work on this project, and I want Lisa to work on the other project, and I want somebody else to work on the other project, because they know who you are. Mm-hmm. But in the real world, that's not the case. So when you get to Cal, and you're sitting in a class with 2,000 people in it, there's almost no way that that performer, as you said, at the front of the class is going to be able to single you out. Just statistically, it's unlikely. But that's a metaphor for life as well. And what it means is that if you want to participate in something that's not in your, and I'll use your word, neighborhood, you have to stand up and ask for it. I want to do that. And that's a big learning point for people, is that no one's going to call on you. If you want something, you have to go get it.
Yeah, I really agree with you. And I think that's definitely something that Berkeley has taught me in the past year and a half.
Right. And that's awesome. Because if you've learned nothing else, and you've learned way more than that, but if you've learned nothing else, that's one of the best things to learn. Anyway, I really want to thank you so much for your time, Ken. This has been awesome for me.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.